Well, I don't know about you, but to me, there's nothing quite as good as a good crackling spy story. Cloak and dagger, people hiding around corners, secret codes, espionage of all sorts. Of course, you have to have a femme fatale as well. I've read my share of spy novels, and I've heard my share of spy stories, and one of my favorite sources of spy stories is my buddy, Dr. Joseph Fitzanakis from King University, who runs the King Institute for Security and Intelligence Studies. And today, Joseph is in the studio. He's going to tell us all about the latest brouhaha over cyber espionage. That's using the internet to spy on other countries, which is what we do and what they do. And recently, it's come to the fore because it turns out we and China have very different ideas about what's permissible and what isn't. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about cyber espionage.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Joseph Fitzanakis is a buddy of mine who teaches security and intelligence studies at nearby King University in Bristol, Tennessee. Joseph and I met each other several years ago when he was on a local television station talking about Edward Snowden. I guess it was a little over a year ago, talking about Edward Snowden and the Verizon phone record scandal, which, of course, has exploded in a thousand different directions since then. And he was on one segment, I was on another segment, and apparently we were both, each was impressed with the other. Because when I called him up, he said, "Oh, yeah, I saw you, and I listened to your show." And we went back and forth, and I said, "Well, you've got to come on, and you've got to tell me more about this spying stuff." And by golly, he has. Joseph has been on several times and will be on, no doubt, many times in the future. And today we have a real treat for you because he agreed to come on and talk about the recent scandal that's erupted in the news. You may have heard that President Obama not only has been complaining about Chinese cyber espionage, as the Chinese complain about our cyber espionage. And of course, that piqued my curiosity. And whenever I have curiosity about such matters, I know who to call. Here he is, Joseph Fitzanakis. Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, we're glad to have you. So what have you been up to lately?
Well, you know, I've started teaching courses on security and intelligence several years ago, and there's a lot of interest in this field. Mm-hmm. And I always keep thinking, is this thing going to peak at some point? Well, unfortunately or fortunately, depending how you look at it, national and international events ensure that this field of study is still very much popular. And I'm referring, of course, to the situation in Syria, in Iraq, where ISIS now is taking over huge swaths of the territory. So with the big news in our field right now is, of course, looking at this huge Sunni insurgency that's happening in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, some of the more continuous themes in the field, in my case, I have a great interest in cybersecurity. Mm. Cyber espionage.
And that's what brought me once again to your attention. I know you had posted on your Facebook site that you just got a paper published, haven't you, on this very issue?
Yes, I published a sort of a working research paper on the subject at the École Spéciale Militaire de Sanseur, which is the...
Oh, that sounds French to me.
Thanks very much.
You're going to have to translate that for us.
I will. It's the French equivalent of the West Point Military Academy. Mm. And they have some sort of an institute of cybersecurity. And I published a paper there in English on the subject of cyber espionage.
Tell us a little bit about this paper. It's got a really interesting title, Should State-Sponsored Cyber Operations Target the Private Sector? And then you subtitle it American and Chinese Assessments. I'm guessing there's going to be some contrast between the two sides.
There is, and as in many other things between the two. By cyber operations, we mean especially, in this case, cyber espionage. Which is essentially the use of network computers to access illegally classified or restricted information. And cyber espionage, you would not be surprised to hear, has been around for as long as computers have been around, network computers at least, connected to the internet. Countries don't like to talk about this, but it's become pretty obvious in the last, say, 10 years or so that pretty much every country is involved in some kind of cyber espionage.
I have to make a point here. It seems to me that every time a new technology emerges, the first thing people do is use them objectionably. think back to when photography was invented. I think the first pictures were probably what we would call, you know, 19th century pornographic. I mean, well, we got this new invention. Let's take pictures of naked women, you know. And similarly, I mean, there's a new recording technology or a new surveillance technology. The first thing we do, we start spying on each other with them. So that's sort of an open secret, isn't it, that people would be using these tools and have been for a long time?
It is. It's actually interesting that, you know, the technologists and technology designers come up with these ideas for new technologies, and then they put them in the market, and people use them in totally different ways than they had envisaged, you know, in the beginning. So, and that applies to pretty much every communications technology, including cell phones. Teenagers get in trouble all the time with cell phones. That's not what, you know, what Apple envisaged back when they were when put cameras in their cell phones.
Okay, so you've got, you're basically looking at the current state, I guess, of that cyber espionage. Is that what your focus is now?
I think it's fascinating in all sorts of ways, politically and also legally. Speaking, what prompted this last paper that I wrote was a very interesting case back in I believe it was April when the United States, for the first time, named five officials of the Chinese armed forces and indicted them with cyber espionage.
That is just remarkable. I mean, we don't generally even see indictments for this sort of activity of any kind.
That's exactly right.
And so what in the world prompted this extremely unusual, and we don't certainly bring out the identities of people we think are spying on us from, you know, bunkers over somewhere in China. How did this come about? What's going on?
Well, it was indeed a very peculiar case. It's the first time in history that America, and I believe any country, has actually named foreign alleged intelligence officers in an indictment, a legal indictment.
Yeah, in fact, let me just flesh this out a little bit. Whenever you see somebody being arrested for spying, it's typically your own nationals, right? So if I were, you know, spying for the Chinese here in the United States and I got caught, then I would probably be put in prison, tried for treason or for violating the Espionage Act or something. But if you catch a foreign spy, they're treated sort of like POWs, right? I mean, then they're maybe put in prison, but then they're exchanged later. I mean, you know, that we treat foreigners differently when they spy on us than we do our own people. Or am I missing the boat here?
No, you're not. The reason for that is actually quite straightforward, is mm-hmm. that most foreigners that spy, say, on the United States come here with diplomatic immunity. So they're diplomats.
Right.
Pretending to be diplomats when in fact they are agents of an intelligence agency or officers of an intelligence agency. Once they get caught, they have immunity. So the worst thing you can do to them is perhaps expel them, mm-hmm. sometimes exchange them for somebody else. You can't do anything else with them. Unless, of course, they're on illegals, meaning that they come here, they have no connection with their nation's or another nation's embassy anywhere in the United States. People like Rudolf Abel back in the Cold War, mm-hmm. Real name William Fisher, he came here posed as a British photographer, was in fact a KGB officer and was arrested in the 1950s. Now, he was not here with diplomatic immunity, therefore he could be arrested and, in fact, was exchanged with Francis Gary Powers, the U-2 pilot. And, of course, the Chinese have indicated in very certain ways that they will never, ever extradite those people.
Well, I wouldn't expect them to. And I'm not taking the Chinese part. Folks, I am not saying it's okay for the Chinese to spy on us. I'm simply saying this is just a weird way to handle it.
Right. Now, there's a reason for why the United States actually named those individuals. And the reason is that they were caught, according to the Department of Justice, spying on America not for national security reasons, but for economic reasons.
Oh, so like they were spying on IBM to figure out what the latest technology was so they could then give it to the Chinese equivalent of IBM and give them a competitive advantage?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Well, okay. Now just let's just pause and think about that for a moment. I guess that means that the United States has set up in its own procedures and policies that we only spy on foreign governments, but we don't spy on foreign businesses? Is that the distinction that we're making?
It seems so. It was actually very interesting to watch the press statement, press conference that the Department of Justice held to announce this. Eric Holder was there. Mm-hmm. And he said that he didn't exactly say this, but he implied that, look, I mean, we all spy on each other. That's fine. America spies on the Chinese as well. But we do not do it in order to help American companies, private companies, get an edge in the market. And that's what it appears, or at least the Department of Justice says the Chinese did.
Okay. Now, again, just to flesh this out a little bit, and I guess the distinction here would be that if you're spying on a foreign country, if we're trying to break into the, you know, the Peking's, Beijing, I guess it's pronounced these days, Department of Defense, to figure out the design of their latest rocket, that is in some sense okay, or at least it's acknowledged that it happens. But if we were trying to spy on the Chinese IBM or the Chinese Microsoft, that would simply be stealing trade secrets.
Right.
And just again, to see where we get this idea, if Microsoft were doing this itself against the Chinese Microsoft, that would be considered a crime.
Right.
If you had private actors on both sides of the equation, one of them spying on the other, even if you had two American companies spying, if Pepsi were trying to find out the secret formula for Coke by breaking into Coke's network, that would be considered thievery of trade secrets. Okay, well, now I guess I understand what they're trying to say. Some things are crimes, some things are national security. Is that a fair statement of what our position is?
Sure, and you can actually argue that in the international context, which defines the relations between states, when it comes to espionage, there are no laws. If you get caught, bad luck. You know, if you don't get caught, continue doing it. When it comes to espionage between companies in the private sector, there are laws. And if you're caught, then you face the criminal penalty.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph Fitsinakis, director of the King University Institute for Security and Intelligence Studies, all about cyber espionage. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Joseph Fitsinakis. Stay tuned. It's the quiz guy coming in, not dressed in green today, so I'm guessing there's no riddle. He's dressed all in purple with a purple tie with little oranges on it. Doug, why are you dressed in this fashion?
Oh, you know, I just dressed up for you.
You're feeling Stuart. Purple today.
I'm not blue, but, spring and summer are upon us, and that's just a great thing.
I know why you're doing this. This is a nonpartisan show, and purple is a blend of blue and red.
Yeah, yeah. If I was reflecting anything in Washington, I wouldn't have oranges on my tie. It would all be bananas.
Well said. I just heard somebody on the line laughing at your joking around. Who do we have on the line?
This is Pat from Tennessee.
Where in Tennessee are you from, Pat?
Near Knoxville.
Near Knoxville, Tennessee. Well, that's a marvelous place. So, Doug, do you have a hard question today for Pat?
You know, I have an incredibly difficult question today.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Harder the better.
Oh, yeah. Pat, welcome to your weekly constitutional. So here comes the question. I'm going to read the question and give you a couple of choices here, okay?
Okay.
What state has the only unicameral legislature?
What's a unicameral legislature?
Just one body, not bicameral. Unicameral.
So there's no House and there's no Senate.
What state has the only unicameral legislature? And not surprisingly, it's also the smallest legislature because there's only one.
There's only one of them. There's just one group called the legislature.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So here, Pat, here's your choices. Is it A, Rhode Island, B, Alaska, C, Nebraska, or D, Utah?
That's kind of like the hardest question you have ever asked on this show.
A, Rhode Island. B, Alaska, where you can see Russia.
Right.
C, Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
So Cornhuskers. Or D, Utah.
Good.
Well, of course, you think Rhode Island because it's the smallest state, just about. And... But then Utah is so all kind of one kind of people there.
But they let more than Mormons in to Utah.
Yeah, I know, but...
It is a relatively homogenous state. You're correct.
Yes. So, let me see.
But what does that have to do with the formation of the legislature? That's why this is hard. I happen to know the answer, but I just happen to know.
Well, you probably do, but I'm not sure. I guess I would just have to go with my first thought and say Rhode Island.
Just go with your first thought, Rhode Island, because it's the smallest state.
Mm-hmm.
Geographically, but what states are the small ones population-wise? Would that make a difference? I wonder if that would make a difference.
Probably Nevada.
Yeah, but that's not one of your choices.
I thought he said Nevada.
You need to give a hint here, Doug. This is far too hard.
No, okay. So, I know it's kind of a corny question.
All right. Now, name the states again.
Go ahead, Doug. It's up to you.
Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
Alaska, Nebraska, or Utah?
Nebraska.
You are correct! That was brilliant!
Now, Doug, come on. There's some extremes going on. That had to be the hardest question and the worst hint, or the easiest hint I've ever heard.
Well, you know, it is a very difficult question because of our 50 states in the Union, they are the only ones that have this unicameral system. And they actually used to be bicameral, but... one of the early Nebraskan fathers of politics and government there had an experience in Australia, came back in the 1930s and said, hey, do we really need two chambers here? We could probably do it all in one. And so today, the system has just one chamber. Everyone's referred to as a senator, and it's actually the smallest legislature because there's only one body. But still only about 40, 46 members. That's pretty small. That really concentrates a lot of power into a few hands. But as you say, Nebraska, not that big. I mean, let's face it. The Cornhuskers, when they're playing ball on football on a Saturday afternoon, I think the stadium is the largest city in the state.
Pat, before that remarkable hint from Doug,
does that mean that I don't get a T-shirt?
You get a half a T-shirt, I think, half it, because that was...
Give her the front half.
The front half. You can get the front half of the T-shirt. That's the part with the logo on it. What you need to do is send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your size, and we will be happy to send you a shirt, Pat.
Small.
You need to send the email. I know that email.
I like the unicameral.
That's great. You know, I'm not surprised at all. That was a challenging question.
Yes.
You know, most legislatures were unicameral, even Virginia's.
Right.
I mean, it was...
General Assembly or the House of Burgesses,
The
right?
House of Burgesses became the House of Delegates. That's right. Exactly right.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I've long thought that. In fact, you know, we have two houses of the National Congress because of a compromise between the large states and the small states. It's not necessary to do that same sort of compromise on a state level. I'm just wondering to what extent the state constitutions have bicameral legislatures just kind of as a default setting.
Well, you know, you've hit on a great point, which is probably topic for a future show, which is that it's really up to the states to decide what their legislature is going to look like. It's not a template the federal government hands down.
What do you think about that, Pat? Should we have unicameral legislatures or should we keep the current system?
Absolutely.
Absolutely have unicameral legislatures.
Yes.
Well, then...
There's far too many people up there to argue.
Far too many people argue. Well, maybe we'll simplify things then.
Yes.
Okay, well, Pat, thanks very much and congratulations on winning yourself a T-shirt. Wear it proudly.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the article.
There ain't nobody to smile like a... Head don't feel afraid of an undercover raid. There's no need to fuss. Ain't nobody to smile like a... Smile like a...
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy, Dr. Joseph Fitsanakis of King University, all about cyber espionage. Before the break, we were talking about how China and the United States view this rather differently, and it all has something to do with trade secrets.
So we've crossed some line, or the Chinese have, we say, by spying using the tools of the state to then aid private companies. We've crossed over from national security activities into criminal activities. Okay, so obviously the Chinese then said, oh, sorry, sure, we'll send the guys over.
No, the Chinese actually reject every one of these accusations. They say that they never, ever have conducted not only economic espionage, but any kind of cyber espionage against the United States.
Okay, so they're still in their denial phase.
Absolutely.
They're not even admitting that they spy. Okay, well, I understand that, and I understand that stance. But there's a more fundamental objection, isn't there? I mean, even if they were to acknowledge that they spy, they don't view this as a clear, delineated public versus private thing, do they?
Right. It's actually very interesting to read the statements, the official statements of the two governments, because they're saying so many things if you read between the lines. So in the case of the Chinese, they responded almost immediately, stating that this distinction between private and public in terms of espionage is a fake distinction created by the United States to give America an advantage in the world of cyber espionage. And when I first came across this, I was puzzled. I was like, why would that give anybody an advantage? How would that even create a situation of advantage for one of the two adversaries? And it took me a while to realize it. And then it suddenly came to me what the Chinese were saying. And what they're saying is that it makes a difference whether you make that distinction based on the structure of the two nations' economies. Because if you think about this, in America, we have a very strong, sort of almost like a cultural distinction between private and public, right? So in America, for instance, you have things that belong to the government, or a government sort of authorized or controlled, and you have the private life of citizens, which includes, of course, civil society, and includes corporations, companies, and so on and so forth. And Americans have this very sort of sacred idea of ownership and property, right? If you think about the Chinese case, yes, China, of course, has become a lot more capitalist in the last, say, 10 to 15 years than it was before. But still, the society itself doesn't have this sort of very sort of sacred, almost religious differentiation between public and private. And for the Chinese economy, yes, there are many big companies now that are competing internationally and that are very private in the sense that we understand them in America. But the entire economy of China is still controlled by about 200 or so large Chinese corporations that belong either completely or, for the most part, to the government. And we're talking here about utilities. We're talking about the defense sector in particular.
So if the Chinese were to accept our distinction, then the simple difference in the structure of our two economies would mean that there was more fair game in their country than there is in our country.
Sure, because
we could spy on more because we could spy not just on their government, but all their government-owned companies.
Right.
Whereas they could only spy on our government because we don't have that many government-owned companies.
Right. And in fact, our government is very, very small compared to the Chinese sector or the public sector. For instance, our government has become so privatized in the post-war era that even our defense sector is now almost completely privatized.
Yeah, but that brings up another issue. And the other issue is that even though technically General Dynamics or Raytheon, as you point out in your paper, might be private companies, they're private companies whose almost exclusively work for the government. In fact, most of our defense activities, most of our research, most of our weapons development takes place with private companies. And this is something I actually know a little bit about. I'll digress here slightly and say that my very first job out of law school was when I worked on Capitol Hill for the chief counsel of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. And I have to admit a great deal of ignorance when I came there. Of course, I'd heard of the Corps of Engineers. And I figured, basically you just got lots of guys in uniforms running around building dams and building locks and navigation systems, as well as pontoon bridges for combat. And then I was very quickly disabused of that notion. I said, you know, we certainly have guys in uniform. They do build pontoon bridges for combat operations, but that's the military side. The civil side of the Corps of Engineers relies almost exclusively on contractors. So all those major Corps of Engineers projects all over our country, rivers, harbors, dams, flood control, all that stuff. Yeah, you've probably got some guy in a uniform, a colonel or a general running the show. But all the people actually doing the work are private contractors. In fact, the Corps of Engineers was described to me as the largest government contracting agency in the world at that time. So that's how we do it in the United States. You know, the government spends the money, but it's almost all done by private contractors. And so that blurs this otherwise clean distinction that we would like to draw between national security spying and private sector spying. Who's to say which is happening when the Chinese spy on some major contractor for the Corps of Engineers or for the Department of Defense?
Right. So, for instance, if Raytheon was working on a top secret project for the government, Raytheon technically is a private corporation, and it has a private corporate structure. It's not controlled by the government. And the Chinese are saying, so you're telling us we can't spy on Raytheon because it's a private company. But in reality, if you look at this more carefully, Raytheon, for the most part, has only one client, which is the United States government, and it cannot be allowed to fail. So it's pretty much protected by the state. It's a capitalist company, but lives in a socialist environment almost, you know, which is very convenient. The reason we have that, by the way, is so that we can basically, the state does not dominate the defense industry, which is a huge industry. If we considered Raytheon and Boeing and companies of that nature as public-owned companies, the way we look at the American economy would change forever, because we'll see that basically the government controls huge swaths of corporate territory out there.
And which, so actually, again, we do.
We do, actually.
When you think of, in fact, there's a term that's often used in Washington for all of these contractors, I think particularly the defense contractors, they're called Beltway Bandits.
Right.
And I first heard this term back in the 1980s when I was working on some research on defense spending and military matters. And I found that many of the interviewers, I would call up the Pentagon and I'd say, hey, can I talk to you about this? Can I talk to you about that? And, you know, sometimes they'd say yes, sometimes they'd say no, but often they would say, well, the guy you really need to talk to is Joe, and he works over at such and such the company. And I found myself interviewing and talking to private contractors as much as I was to Pentagon people.
Right.
That's just the way we roll here.
Another term we use for that is the core defense industry.
Right.
Which is a lucrative, by the way, a lucrative industry.
Just say the offices I went to were very, very nice.
Very nice, right?
Yes,
nice,
not furniture. In the Pentagon, but in the private
sector. Pentagon is actually a very dilapidated building compared to those corporate buildings. Another thing that's interesting about them, you know, they also incidentally have had a boom since 9/11 because...
Oh, of course, yes. Right?
And we used to be the case that the only kind of areas of government that were sort of privatized were more of the technical areas, weapons production and so on and so forth. But nowadays, we're seeing the same kind of creeping of the private sector into the intelligence world as well.
Yes, yes. I've been reading about that. Tell us more about that.
Well, I mean, essentially what's happened is after the end of the Cold War, the budgets for the intelligence community dropped substantially, which was part of a global trend, by the way. Tensions became less pressing, as it were. And so many countries decided to allocate funds elsewhere. When 9/11 happened, America did not have enough experts in the Middle Eastern or Central Asian region. And so we started relying on these private companies that could supply us these specialists, but for a lot higher pay, right? Now, what happens nowadays, incidentally, which is something that I think connects to the argument in my paper, is that these companies are allowed to entice current government employees in the intelligence community with higher pay. So let's say, for instance, that the Central Intelligence Agency found an expert in some, you know, really obscure dialect in Kenya, which we really, really need to have. The guy passed through security background clearings. Everything's fine. No connection to any kind of terrorist organizations. Nothing suspicious. He gets trained for years and years. He gets ready to operate in the field. Then this private company will approach them and say, hey, how much are you making? $60,000 a year? What if I give you twice that? All you have to do is come work for me. Quit your job. They quit their job. Go for this private company. The company then approaches the government and says, that guy that you really need, now he works for me. And now sell them to you for three times the price, you know?
Right.
So they pocket one third, they give the other person two thirds, and that apparently is legal. It's come to the point now where in several American intelligence agencies, they used to have a cafeterias where people or visitors can go in there and eat. They have now two separate cafeterias, one for contractors and one for the employees, so the two will not mix and be able to be enticed by the contract.
Seriously?
Right.
And of course, I'm sure that's all based on security concerns.
Right, yes. Yeah. Now, the Chinese are looking at this and are saying, wait a minute, so you're now privatizing your intelligence and your security compartments of your government, and now you're telling us we can't spy on them because they're private. Well, they're not obviously accepting this. They're not accepting that distinction.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph Fitsinakis, the director of the King Institute for Security and Intelligence Studies at King University in Bristol, Tennessee. And we're talking about cyber espionage, and we're talking about the different ways that China and the United States look at it. It turns out that while the U.S. tries to draw a very stark line between private companies and government spying, some of our own actions in terms of privatizing our own intelligence gathering, let's just say that the Chinese think of them as being somewhat hypocritical. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Joseph Fitsinakis. Don't touch that dial.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow.
Montpelier is the site of many annual events. The annual Montpelier Hunt Races, an autumn steeplechase event, were started by Marion DuPont Scott and her brother William DuPont Jr. in 1934. The races are held the first Saturday in November. Montpelier has one of the few steeplechase tracks in the country that use traditional hedgerows for jumps. The Montpelier Wine Festival showcases distinctive arts and crafts, specialty food vendors, local agricultural products, and Virginia wine from approximately 25 different wineries in the state. The Fall Fiber Festival is held each October and showcases every aspect of textile manufacturing, from the production of wool to the finished product, and the sheepdog trials. Other events include summer programs for children, a barbecue held in the summer, archaeology expeditions, Civil War demonstrations, and a candlelight tour of Montpelier in the evening. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy Joseph Fitsinakis from King University. We're talking about cyber espionage and specifically about the different ways that China and the United States look at it. The United States tends to differentiate the difference between a country spying on another government and a country spying on private businesses within the other country, and what's done with the intelligence when it's gathered. But the Chinese consider the U.S.'s approach to be somewhat, shall we say, inconsistent.
It's actually a very interesting discussion in general, because I think that espionage has been with us for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. Espionage sometimes wins wars or loses wars, depending on how you use it. And very few countries in the world are willing to turn their backs on this practice of espionage. The Chinese, of course, have been practicing espionage for thousands of years. The Chinese school of espionage is one of the oldest in the world. And these guys have been doing this going back to the dynasties and what have you. The United States is a very new sort of, it's a very new arrival in the field of espionage. America didn't even have a organized intelligence sector until pretty much World War II, to be frank.
Right. In fact, let me pause here. I'm sure you can know more about this than I do, but there was a wonderful story. I think it involved Henry Stimson around World War I, when there was a suggestion that we should have an organized intelligence service. Are you familiar with that? And his response?
His response was, "Gentlemen, don't read other gentlemen's mail."
Oh, boy.
So he shut it down.
Yes, that's it. That's a laudable, laudable statement. It really and truly is. But it underscores something else that I'm sure you're very familiar with, is that isn't it strange that we have one moral code that we observe individually and that to a great extent does inform our political decisions? I mean, we hold, or we at least purport to hold, our political leaders to a high moral code. I mean, when Bill Clinton engaged in his extracurricular activities, people said, when you've got a president, we want him to be a good person and by private moral standards as well. But when it comes to the actual behavior of the nation state itself, it's as if we've re-entered the state of nature that Thomas Hobbes talked about. We're back in the jungle and anything goes. In fact, a leader today who said, "Gentlemen, don't read other gentleman's mail would be considered engaging in irresponsible behavior, failing in his duty to the country. We could never shut down our intelligence gathering activities. It really would be irresponsible.
Sure, and I think, you know, we mentioned before, it doesn't sound like we're taking the Chinese side, but in fact, if you look at the two models of espionage, one presented by the United States, one presented by China, they both, of course, present huge moral dilemmas and huge ethical dilemmas and legal dilemmas. Every intelligence agency has skeletons in its closet, and America is no exception to that. The difference, of course, is that in the United States, because of our constitutional structure that applies to this country, American intelligence agencies are forced to be very transparent in comparison to equivalent agencies in other, even Western European countries, let alone China. I give an example. I mean, it's incredible when you look at how many documents are classified almost on a daily basis in the United States intelligence community. We're talking, there's so much declassification going on right now that sometimes it takes researchers like me years to actually go through documents that are being declassified. In China, the Chinese equivalent of the CIA doesn't even have a website. It doesn't exist, right?
Right.
So there are definitely two different models. And there's no question in my mind that the Chinese are definitely, shall we say, unscrupulous when it comes to international espionage. They think that for them, for the Chinese, financial power, even if it's private companies that are Chinese, equals state power, right? So they're definitely are not willing, at least based on what we see them do, not what they say. They see Chinese economic power as a key to world domination, or at least international domination. America does not see it quite that way. Having said that, right? Having said that, the Chinese have gotten back with us and said, look, based on the revelations by Edward Snowden, you guys are involved in some very, very offensive intelligence yeah. operations using computers as well.
And I have to point out, Edward Snowden worked for a contractor.
For a contractor.
Right.
Ironic.
I mean, so what are we saying? The Chinese can't spy on that contractor because it's a private company?
Sure. And contractors, you know, because of their increased role in the overall intelligence community in the United States, contractors play an increasingly important role in terms of security and security failures. One of them is, of course, Edward Snowden. Some people say that because the contractors are profit-making operations, right? This is, in fact, the irony is that, say, the Pentagon or the CIA are not for-profit companies. They're not trying to make a profit. They're trying to protect national security and to advance American national interests. The moment you bring in some company that may be American-owned, but in fact has its main concern is its shareholders, then how do those things meet? And some people say that when they hire individuals to work for them, they're looking at the bottom line, which is the dollar, and they're not doing as careful background checks as they should be doing, as what the government would do. And perhaps Snowden is one such case.
Yeah, that brings up a whole other issue with regard to contracting in the national defense realm. Then we could even go off and talk about things like Blackwater and, you know, the loss of control of people who are effectively mercenaries. But I think we would probably stray a little far if we went down that road. I do want to throw you a curveball here because something, when I was reading your paper, something occurred to me. Whenever I read about intelligence activities, and especially in your paper, when you start talking about the Greeks and the Turks and the Italians and all the other countries that are out there and how they're all spying on each other, or cooperating, and the Australians cooperating with us and all the rest of it, my head begins to spin. And I'm reminded of the novels of John Le Carré. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Well, who isn't?
Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't sure. I mean, it was not necessarily true. He's obviously a very famous international writer, and he writes about spies. But it's anything but James Bondish. It doesn't glorify it at all. In fact, if there's any stream or strain that runs through it all, it's that this is a soul-destroying profession, and that people live their entire careers in a state of deception. And their jobs force them to do things that their individual morality rebels against. And you can't trust anyone about anything. I'm just wondering how you would react to that. I mean, do you think that those sort of descriptions of the espionage racket, as it were, are in any way accurate? Or do you have any reaction to that sort of portrayal?
Ethics and morality are actually a very big part of intelligence work. In fact, at King, where I teach, we are starting to teach a course this coming fall called Intelligence Ethics.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Absolutely. There's actually a whole field of study called intelligence ethics.
Oh, pray tell. Okay, right.
And there is also a journal that comes out called Intelligence Ethics. There's an association for intelligence ethics. Intelligence professionals have to undergo training in intelligence ethics as part of their career.
This is astonishing to me. What is an ethical limit that an intelligence officer, at least in the United States, might feel that he or she had to observe?
So, for instance, if you, let's say, take the example of organizations that do covert work, like, say, the CIA,
right.
That send out actual officers in the field to conduct intelligence. These operatives, they don't do spying. I'm not going to train you and spend millions of dollars to train you to send you out to another country and then be caught climbing a fence somewhere, because that would end your career. Even if you're just exchanged, come back to the States, you can never go back in the field. Plus, I'm going to lose a lot of investment on you. So what your job is to hire locals to do that for you, is to try to recruit locals, so-called assets, to do the spying.
So they're the ones that... Spies don't actually spy.
They don't actually spy.
But do they get to wear tuxedos?
Sometimes.
And play baccarat at
casinos? Often. Yeah, the average life of a CIA officer is basically taking a lot of time to go to cocktail parties at different embassies and try to recruit foreign diplomats, you know. But you don't do the spying. You don't, like, break into offices and climb fences and steal. The others do that for you because they're much more expendable in a way. But at the same time, when you recruit a person like that, your ethical duty to that person is supreme. You will not let that person go down. You sometimes often risk your life to get them out if the need be, you know, because you develop
a relationship. So wait a minute, if I'm out there and I am recruiting spies in Russia, for example, and I get someone to agree to spy for me, and I think the expression is I run that agent, right? And then all of a sudden it becomes clear that that agent has been compromised or might be compromised, then I have an ethical duty to try to rescue that agent. And
that is your most supreme ethical duty in your job. In fact, not just them, but also their families.
A second. It says my most supreme ethical duty, but what if my duty to the United States means that I have to keep putting them into danger, even to the extent of their family or they being caught and executed?
The answer to that is that this probably has happened somewhere. I'm not saying that it hasn't, but the argument to that is you might get some short-term benefit from that for a particular operation or for your career.
Right.
But long-term, that damages the agency itself, because if you're an agency like the CIA or like, say, the Russian FSB, you want to show potential recruits that you will be there for them if they need you.
Okay,
because if you're not, you can't recruit. Therefore, you can't do your job.
That seems to me to be a practical reason. I mean, if I'm running the CIA, I want everyone to know, or at least potential spies out there to know, that the CIA looks after you once, you know, you agree to spy for us. But I wouldn't necessarily call that an ethical duty or a moral duty.
Right. But ethics come into it, because in the process of developing that agent and running, as you say, that agent, you become so close to them that if you lose them, it's almost like losing somebody who is a very close personal friend. And sometimes it's kind of like a war. You know, when you go up in the field and start fighting, people go to war for all kinds of join the military for all kinds of reasons. Patriotism, duty to country, willingness to serve. But the fact is, if you talk to soldiers, when you're out there with your gun shooting an enemy or getting enemy fire back, you're not fighting for anything more than you and your comrades at that moment. You're trying to save your life. You're kind of trying to save the life of the people that you train with and you've been with and you trust and you respect. That's at that very second, that's all you can think of. Other things come in afterwards, you know, the kind of the context in which all this is happening. It's the same with intelligence. Intelligence is nothing more or nothing less than developing friendships, relationships of trust. Now, here's the interesting moral thing about this as well, is that, and I think you kind of hint to that, when you go abroad as, say, a CIA officer and your job is to spy, the moment you step foot on a foreign country and you have not declared yourself as an intelligence officer, you're breaking their law because you're acting as an unregistered agent for a foreign country.
Now, I still have my diplomatic immunity if
sure.
I've gone over there, but I'm really doing something I'm not supposed to be doing.
The moment you step foot on that country, you don't have to do anything.
Right.
Just because you haven't declared yourself as an officer of the CIA, you're breaking the law. And you continue to break the law in all sorts of ways throughout your career every time you station abroad. But what the agency expects you to do is the moment you get back home, to be the exemplary, almost like military style, intelligence officer. Follow the rules of this country, follow the rules of the agency, be ethical, be upfront, be legally compliant with everything. So you have these two split personalities. But the best intelligence officers are those who can compartmentalize the two and don't let them mix.
That's tough.
Very tough.
Very, very tough. So is it fair to say that you like the novels of John Le Carré?
John Le Carré has worked as an intelligence officer.
Right.
For MI6
right.
back in the war. So he knows. And to be frank, yes, the technology has changed
right.
in how people train intelligence officers nowadays. But the fundamentals of the profession have remained, particularly in Britain, have remained unchanged for over 200 years, if not longer. So Le Carré is actually focusing on these fundamentals. That's why his novels are so interesting,
mm-hmm.
because these fundamentals are constantly a field of struggle, not just for intelligence officers, but also for their superiors. And some people actually will crack. For instance, you can argue that Edward Snowden, if you accept that he is a genuine whistleblower and not a defector, which is in itself a matter for debate, some people just crack under the pressure. And they say, you know, I cannot ethically do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they will just become whistleblowers or actually, you know, defect for moral reasons and
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth. Others find ways to deal with those kinds of things on a personal level by struggling privately and so on and so forth. I mean,
that was the theme of a really good movie, or at least I thought it was a very good movie a few years ago, starring Matt Damon. It was called The Good Shepherd. And it was about a fellow who was essentially there at the creation of the CIA, and it showed the great focus of it was the toll on his personal life. And I think that he was experiencing what you're describing.
Yes, and I think, you know, we often, when we think about agents like the CIA, which of course have a dark side to them, there's no question about this, as many such, you know, even the Pentagon has a dark side.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to go all the way to intelligence. We forget, we kind of think of them as kind of, you know, overthrowing governments and, you know, sort of running, you know, illegal substances through borders and stuff like that. But in reality, if you look at when espionage is the most useful, it's times when the very existence of our state has been compromised or has been in question. For instance, in World War II,
mm-hmm.
you know, I could spend here all day talking to you about American and also other allied intelligence agents who, with tremendous courage and personal sacrifice, helped us win the war against Nazism. You know, there are cases of agents who, even the president has admitted, that if it weren't for them, the war might have been lost, A, or B, might have dragged on for many more years.
Okay, now, of course, you're just intriguing me, and we don't have time today to go into all of that, but since you've mentioned it, pick one brief anecdote from World War II, a tale of daring do, and great personal risk, and share it with us now. And that'll whet people's appetite for another episode that we're going to devote to World War II and spying. So give me one now. Give me a little something now.
Well, let's take an Allied intelligence officer, and that's going to be sort of like controversial, I guess, because we don't think of it this way now. But remember back during the war, the United States and the USSR were allies.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, fought the same enemy. In fact, it's a testament to Hitler's inadequacy as a strategist that he actually managed to get America and Russia in the same side. That took talent.
It took probably the biggest mistake he made, but please go on.
One of the sort of classic cases of an intelligence operative was Richard Sorge, who was a Russian of German descent, officer of the secret services in Russia, who was sent by Stalin to Japan to find out basically what the Japanese were planning for the war. The big question in Russian military policy was, they were fighting the Germans. This is now 1941-42.
Right.
They were fighting the Germans. They were, you know, they were almost cracking under the pressure. The Allies had not yet invaded Western Europe yet. So there was only one front in the war. The question was, Japan, who was an ally of the Germans, were they going to also invade Russia from the east? Because they
right.
were thinking about this, and that would have created two fronts. That would have been pretty much the end of the Russian effort in the war. And Sorge's job was to go there posing as a German, because he was born in Germany. He spoke fluent German, so he wasn't connected to the embassy. He was an illegal, right? If he had been caught, there's no way he could escape. And his job was to find out whether Japan had decided to attack or not. If Stalin knew that Japan was not going to attack, he could take all of his troops in the east, take him to the front in the west, and then basically chase the Germans all the way to Berlin, which is what he finally did. Mm-hmm. And Sorge managed to go in there, gain the trust of the German embassy in Tokyo, eventually rise to become their press secretary, and eventually found out that the Japanese had decided not to invade Russia.
Wow.
He told that to Stalin, and many intelligence historians, and in fact military historians, credit him with the final Soviet turn of the tide, as it were, in Stalingrad, and the ability to basically finish the war by chasing the Germans all the way back to Berlin.
That is a great story.
Sorge was caught eventually and was tortured by the Japanese and hanged.
Oh, that's not such a great story. No. Now, you could have left that part out,
See,
Joseph.
See, but that's the heroism I'm talking about.
It is. It is indeed. Well, that's a great story, and we're going to do another episode. We're just going to call it World War II Spies. But we've strayed a little bit from our original thing. Is it safe to say that this latest brouhaha between us and the Chinese, the two countries are simply not going to see eye to eye on this, and that it's unlikely that anything else is going to happen?
My feeling is that the United States will eventually have to succumb to the pressure to start copying the Japanese. But that's just an informal...
Chinese, I'm sorry.
And probably the Japanese, as I think of it.
Yeah, as well, yeah.
Right.
Okay, well, so essentially, I hesitate to say it this way because it's probably an overstatement, but it sounds as if that even though we do lots of very aggressive spying, that we still suffer from what one might call the Boy Scout syndrome, that we're still trying to hold ourselves to some different standard. Even going back to Henry Stimson's statement about not reading other gentlemen's mail, in a world where other countries have no problem and don't have any of the concerns about transparency that our intelligence agencies do, and maybe we're just going to be forced, as you say, just to do things their way and to drop what the Chinese see as a false distinction between public and private spying.
Absolutely. I think the United States, it has this kind of culture, maybe it has to do with the Protestantism, that's very, very like big on ethical sort of ethical doctrines. And Americans have always tried to basically show that their intelligence agencies, unlike other nations' intelligence agencies, are far more responsive to the Constitution, they're far more transparent, far more ethical. In many cases, that has shown itself not to be the case. In other cases, actually, this applies. I mean, part of my job is to explain to my students why it is that the CIA, which exists, has to be different than, say, an agency like the so-called KGB that used to be around in the Soviet Union. Those two agencies have some of the same practices. They often train their agents the same way, as in the case, for example, of the current Russian version of the KGB, the FSB. Mm-hmm. They have the same type of training, the same type of activities, but there has to be a qualitative difference between the CIA and the KGB or the FSB, because one operates under a democratic society. And that difference, that distinction is what makes or breaks the reputation of an intelligence agency in a democratic society.
Well, we'll no doubt return to these issues as time goes on. But for now, Joseph Fitsinakis of King University and of the King Institute for Security and Intelligence Studies, or KISIS, right? And you're the director of that particular agency, but I guess what you call it, what, a center?
An institute.
An institute. You're the director of that institute. Thank you very much for coming back and illuminating this latest brouhaha over the Chinese and cyber espionage. And that's our show. Wasn't that a fascinating discussion of a fascinating topic with a fascinating and very dashing fellow, Joseph Fitsinakis? Hey, he's got a beard. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our Madison Minute is, of course, by the wonderful Jim Blaylock. And my name is Stuart Harris. And before I leave, let me just give a shout out to WEHC, our affiliate in Emory, Virginia, associated with the wonderful place called Emory and Henry College. Good to be on your station, guys. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.